You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we are early in the week of the 20th of October 2024. And today's broadcast is going to be on a familiar topic, and the title is very simple: Putin in 2024 and beyond. And the President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, one of the most lied about men on this earth, while taking criticism from everybody, both from the right and from the left, but regardless, is the enemy of neoliberalism, also has many victories. And I came across an article by Konstantin Remchukov. He is the editor of Nezavisma Gazeta in Russia. And it's the 10 items that Western leaders need to know before talking with Vladimir Putin or his people. And I liked it. I like lists because it's very well organized. So I'm going to read each and I'm going to comment on them, just like we used to do with Sven. Number one, Putin makes all fundamental decisions personally, on the basis of his own ability, expertise, and sense of historical responsibility. A vivid example of this was the president's speech at the Russian Foreign Ministry on June 14th, in which he outlined the key provisions of Russia's foreign policy priorities and his vision for the formation of a new international order. Most participants in the meeting expected the head of state to speak for no more than half an hour. However, at the meeting, Putin spoke for almost 80 minutes on theses that he had written out himself, which he then later dumbed down for journalists. Now, Putin, I'm the author of the only work of political theory concerning Putin's Russia, what he believes. And it was done, I mean, it's a 10-year-old book now, but really nothing has changed. The fact that he does these things himself, notice it's the complete opposite of what American so-called leaders do. And certainly the present unelected president. That's one thing, and it suggests that he actually knows, unlike American politicians who know very little. In foreign policy, I mean, I think the regime is going to install Kamala, but I'm not going to make a prediction here. And she would be wonderful for the regime because they could use her the same way they used Joe Biden. And in foreign policy, nothing will change, except possibly a war in Iran. Now, I'm not sure what the connection is between speaking for 80 minutes and doing everything himself, but I think the argument is that he is genuinely knowledgeable. I've said before that the last almost scholarly president America's had was Richard Nixon, who knew foreign policy inside and out and was a well-known author on that and other topics, despite being an American politician. You know, he earns respect, at least for that reason. So I think that's the connection. Now, his outline for Russia's foreign policy, formation of a new international order, there's nothing new there. That you could find that in the SCO and BRICS, or in my book for that matter. Nothing has changed in that regard. Number two, the task of ensuring the security of the country and protecting Russians and Russian speakers in Ukraine, which Putin has been facing since 2014, has become the main factor of his rule. He will not hand over power to anyone before the final internationally guaranteed settlement of the issue. He cannot give up control until there is a final, globally recognized solution. Anything short of this would mean handing his successor a messy bunch of unresolved problems. Today, no one in Putin's entourage is better at solving problems than the president himself. He knows this and is firmly convinced of it. Now, he used the phrase internationally guaranteed twice. Well, in two different, internationally guaranteed and then globally recognized. It's the same thing, using different words. But there's nothing final about anything the quote-unquote globe does. That's an abstraction that doesn't exist. The West is going to have to be defeated openly for any guarantees to occur. But I guess what he means is that Putin won't leave power until he's reasonably assured his foreign policy goals have been met and will stick. And he's right. There's not a whole lot of people in Russian politics who can do this sort of thing with the experience and grudging respect that he has earned. The very fact that the regime has to constantly make up stories about him and lie about him show just how beyond them he is. He outplays the West many times. Syria was one of the best. And unfortunately, he's made many mistakes in Ukraine, but yeah, no one is perfect. But not wanting to hand all of these problems over to a successor is a very good thing. Of course, electoral politics in the West have no such connection. Vladimir Putin remains one of the most popular politicians on the planet, and no one in Russia could beat him, no matter what. Therefore, he has absolutely no reason to rig elections, because that's just American projection. That's exactly what the West does. Number three, Putin will not resign. Now, I'm not sure where he's getting this from. There were no calls for him to resign. Anyway, he says at the beginning of September of this year, a schoolgirl in Tuva asked the president, "How will you spend your days if you're just an ordinary guy? That is, not the president." Putin replied, "It's hard for me to imagine that now." This is his most important message of recent times, both for Russians and outsiders. I don't think it's his most important, but I get it. Putin is saying that your own future planning proceed from the basis that I will be in the Kremlin. In this way, the president has delivered a reality check to many Western politicians and indeed Russian opposition activists who have been dreaming and deluding themselves, claiming that if there's Putin present, there's a problem. No Putin, no problem. The exact opposite of that is true, and the tiny opposition movement in Russia is usually connected with American corporations and banks, almost always trained in American universities, and is more at home in Cambridge or New Haven than he is in St. Petersburg. And he's talking about continuity, which is one of the hallmarks of monarchy. And Putin could talk like this due to his popularity. But his popularity is in no small part because of the economic stability that he created over 20 years ago. Saying that I will be in the Kremlin as you make your future plans is to talk to investors, talk to those who want to invest in the Russian economy, and say this stability is going to continue. Because the minute any opposition figures gain power, they'll sell off the country to BlackRock, Western oil companies, whatever they need to, privatizing everything, including and especially the bank. Number four, it is now clear that after more than 2 years of a nuclear threat hanging over us all, the world is ready for real negotiations on the issue. However, there are doubts about whether talks will be successful. The most serious Western politician, now get this here, someone who actually understands the consequences of nuclear war is U.S. President Joe Biden. Okay, so no one's perfect. The guy's an idiot. But he will be gone in a few months. Well, he's been gone since he ran for office. And he didn't even run. They just installed him. Neither Kamala Harris nor Donald Trump have the foreign policy credentials to even grasp the importance of this issue and the dangers involved. Well, that's certainly true. But Biden is he focused on foreign policy, usually making one error after another, anti-Slavic, anti-Russian, very pro-Albanian, as I've written many years ago. No, I shouldn't say many years ago, a couple of years ago. And drug money did come into his campaign from there, such as it was. Now, this is one of the pieces of evidence that I bring up when I say this is not a new Cold War. This is something far more extreme that was portrayed between the U.S. and the USSR throughout the Cold War. There was a huge peace movement. Any fighting the USSR was met with protests. Of course, now there is no anti-nuke group. There is no peace group anywhere, no matter how violent or irrational the wars become. A nuclear threat, which is very unlikely to occur, or the actual use of these weapons. But to say the world is ready for real negotiations, well, of course, that's been the case for a long time. But unlike the talks with Ronald Reagan and his predecessors, this man is saying that these talks, even if they do occur, will likely not be successful. In other words, the irrational projection of hatred on the Russia that politicians and analysts have created is worthy of more hatred than the USSR, which Western politicians didn't hate. They were willing to deal with them. Joe Biden himself went to the USSR in the 1970s, treating everybody there with respect as a diplomat. He went with Richard Lugar of Indiana. And I wrote this back in 16 or 17, I think, treating them as, you know, a legitimate government. The gulags and everything else still function. But of course, Biden and his party still talk about murdering Putin and stuff like that. There's just no comparison between the two. The Cold War was not like that. There were no sanctions on the USSR throughout its existence. In fact, it was subsidized by the West. The only exception to that was in 1980 for the Olympics. But even there, private sector investment poured into the country. The Soviet Union, industrially speaking, years ago, was the creation of Western capitalism. So the dangers of nuclear war certainly are known to everybody. I grew up in the late 70s and early 80s, where this was the number one issue. It isn't anymore. But for him to think that the only person who gets it is Joe Biden, as if he's a normal functioning person, and he never was, and how sad it is that he'll be gone in a few months. Joe Biden is no more or less knowledgeable than Donald Trump or Kamala Harris. So, okay, you know, no one's perfect. I'll let him have it. It's stupid. Number five, the past years and months of the Ukraine conflict, the brutal sanctions, the radical transformation of the driving forces of the Russian economy have clearly demonstrated that it is time for our own domestic public and political consciousness to decisively abandon the notion, once sown by the Polish-American thinker Brzezinski, that Russia's greatness rests on its unity with Ukraine. If the country is torn out of Moscow's sphere of influence, Russia's status as a great power will come to an end, he warned. But that was then, and this is now. Today, it is obvious that Russia's place in the world is guaranteed regardless of the degree of proximity to any country or group of countries. Liberation from speculative constructs in the minds of influential ideologues is a powerful factor in normalizing the development process and assessing fundamental risks and opportunities. Russia can be a great and important power regardless of the degree of integration with other states. The greatness of a country is measured by the level of well-being and opportunities of its citizens, by achievements in healthcare, education, science, and technology. Well, yes and no. I understand what he's saying. Russia is weakened without this Orthodox Slavic huge size of France population in Ukraine. It was always a very advanced part of either the Russian Empire or even the USSR. Yes, he's right. Russia can be a great power without it. But to have a Slavic Orthodox group falling into the Western orbit, pointing at Russia like a dagger, that's a different matter. And it's bad enough that it's in the position it's in. Like, for example, Poland is with Belarus, but that these are people very similar to great Russians. As you know, the Jews who run Kiev are shuttering churches all over the place. It's seemingly the first thing that they do wherever they take power. And of course, everything is privatized and everything is being strip mined and sold off to Western investors. And none of that has even made a dent in the debt that Ukraine owes. They'll never be able to pay it all. but I'm not sure why he's thinking that Ukraine needs to be let go. Well, the central and western part, maybe. But the eastern part could never be, because Kiev has said that they hate them. They're engaging in terror attacks to kill as many Novorossians as possible. So these are two different things. But he did mention in an earlier item that it's not just protecting Russians, but also Russian speakers. And that is relevant in this sense. But yes, Russia by itself can be a completely self-sufficient country. There's only a few countries that claim that. I don't know if China can. It's possible. But I think Russia, the U.S., I don't know about Brazil. Maybe that's going too far, but anyway. He's right in that respect. Number six, talking about the Russian economy, we should keep in mind one simple detail. The federal budget submitted to the State Duma is based on an oil price of $60 per barrel. Now, according to present forecasts, the average annual oil price in 2025 will be $70 a barrel. This is a very high level of conservatism, realism, and sober calculation on the part of Mikhail Mishustin and his government. Remember, he is an economist. Mishustin. I did a show on him when he first became prime minister. The Russian economy is expected to remain manageable, and the pace of development will be sufficient to meet the challenges Russia faces. The obvious structural and technological difficulties will not be decisive. At this level of industrial development, a balanced budget and currency stability are crucial. All right, I'm not sure what country he lives in. There is no question about it being a stable and manageable economy. Any structural or technological difficulties, and all countries have that, is far more manageable than the American. And they will not be decisive. You know, in the area of military technology, Russia is far ahead of the U.S. The Russian budget has been balanced for a long time. They have short-term debt, but that's just for day-to-day financing. Russia's as developed as anyone else, probably beyond the United States, because the U.S. isn't an industrial power anymore. China and Russia are. Now, I also want to keep in mind that Russia is not dependent on oil. Or if she is, the only way she is in terms of export earnings. In terms of the domestic economy, between 8% and 9% of GDP is generated by oil and gas. Now, depending on how you define those two terms, it can, you know, be 12-13%. But Canada and Norway have far more dependency on oil than Russia. Yet it's still, you know, he's talking about this sober calculation. Mishustin's government, as I mentioned when he first took over, I don't even remember when that was, is very conservative. So Russian growth numbers and predictions are always going to be downplaying, even downplaying good things. Number seven, today's fighting makes it clear that the main goal of Russian troops on the ground is to reach the administrative borders of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. When listing his objectives, Putin increasingly uses the following words and phrases: the liberation of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions, Novorossiya. And it can be assumed that Novorossiya is only part of the Kherson and Zaporozhye regions. The main issue is the land connection with Crimea. If my observations are correct, it is possible to draw a more concrete picture that would allow us to say that the military operation has been completed and its goals have been achieved. He's right about that last sentence. Eastern Ukraine will never go back to Kiev. Kiev is a fourth world police state backwater. Didn't have to be, but it is. All the industry that remains is located in the east. Crimea is an extremely prosperous part, as is Chechnya, of the Russian Federation. No one wants to go from first world to fourth world. Hence, being a part of Ukraine has 0% support in any of these areas. The whole point of the invasion was to break the possibility of Ukrainian invasion of Novorossiya. And I include Donbas in that. That was the point. This massive military buildup that no one was talking about. The invasion stopped that. So the basic liberation of eastern Ukraine, the protection of Russian speakers and the church there, which needs protection, and to force Kiev's neutrality, that's the these are the goals of the operation. And the West either didn't know it, I'm talking about journalists here, either didn't know it or didn't care, or don't fully grasp it. You can never overestimate the intelligence. You can never underestimate the intelligence of American journalists. So in that sense, he's absolutely correct. As many of you know, Zelensky is not president of Ukraine. His mandate ran out in May. And so anything he signs, and Putin actually has said this several times, anything he signs is null and void. If I'm not mistaken, I think the Supreme Court, quote unquote, in Kiev is going to rule just on this question. I can't imagine them ruling against Zelensky unless this is a signal that he needs to be replaced. And he needed to be replaced, you know, 3 years ago. Number eight, it should be stressed that in recent months, there has been a clear change in the Russian leadership's assessment of the nature of Ukrainian statehood. This is the main difference from February of 2022. Today, Moscow recognizes that a significant number of Ukrainians voted for the current government, yeah, consider themselves Ukrainians and don't want to see a future with Russia. In this way, the Kremlin recognizes the state of Ukraine. When the West promotes the narrative that Moscow wants to destroy Ukraine as a state, this is an obvious contradiction given the realities today. Moreover, it is this narrative that allows Western politicians to claim that by destroying Ukraine, Russia will move further into Europe, into Poland and the Baltic states. Well, needless to say, anyone who buys that is an absolute moron. Every time there's an enemy of the U.S., the first thing that the journalists say is that they want to take over the world, when in fact, the American and British empires in the past did everything they could to take over the world and almost succeeded. So again, that's more projection. The present level of confidence in Ukraine over Kiev is at, you know, 0%. You could consider yourself Ukrainian and want brotherly relations with Russia. The point of what he's saying here is that no one in Russia has a problem with an independent Ukraine, so long as that independence, as it has been in the past, is used to create a brotherly semi-federation with Russia, but otherwise independent. And they have no reason to become a part of the West, since, as I said many years ago, the West needs nothing that Ukraine produces. Its electronics and industrial might were built and aimed to the Eastern market, not the Western. So those who, you know, so-called nationalists who wanted to become a part of the EU and NATO, I don't know what they're talking about, since there is nothing other than raw materials, I guess, that Ukraine can offer the West that it can't make itself. But I think we all know what the deal really is. Number nine, speaking of possible negotiations, the West fails to mention the question of the legitimacy of Vladimir Zelensky's signature in Putin's eyes. They say it is obvious because Zelensky is flying around the world with his stupid peace plan. I would warn Western partners against simplistic interpretations of Putin's remarks and his concern that the Ukrainian Constitutional Court might later rule that Zelensky had not properly renewed his credentials and that his signature was therefore invalid. Cheated, deceived, hoodwinked, and then deceived again. That's something that will not be allowed to happen again. The level of mutual trust is not even at zero. Total mistrust now makes it necessary to have full negotiating powers in terms of the legal certainty available. So that adds to the earlier idea of international guarantees, which do not exist and can never exist. Now, I've mentioned this already. The very fact that he's acting like a president, and he was installed by the West anyway, that entire government was. Ukrainians aren't voting for Jews. The U.S. ran that election, so-called. Many pro-Russian parties were banned by then. So just like American elections, Ukrainian elections aren't real. But it's entirely the West's fault that there is distrust between Russia and the U.S. Distrust born of American decline and that being projected onto this vaguely understood other, in this case, Russia and China. Finally, number 10. It seems that the issue of a new international order that provides equal security for states is equally relevant today for the critical majority of countries in the world, in the West as well as in the East. The main question is whether it would be possible to create a new international legal framework for peaceful coexistence. All right. Like its Marxist brother, Western capitalism does not accept the existence of any other political system. I've been saying this for decades. Alexander Dugin's been saying this for decades. The regime believes that they are the fulfillers of Enlightenment history, and that the American Empire will do just that. The Marxists say the same thing. It's a historicist understanding of the American mission, which has no connection to the average American, especially average American white man, whatsoever. So liberalism cannot coexist with anything. You cannot repudiate liberalism on the world stage and then claim to be an ally of the U.S. Governments and social systems have to be identical, at least at its fundamentals. Now, I don't know what equal security means. Some states are more secure than others, given their geography. And when he talks about the West in this case, he's not necessarily talking about the regime. He's talking about Western populations. And you notice he doesn't talk about a new international order, because BRICS and the SCO are involved in that. I have numerous talks on those questions in the past. But he's talking about general peaceful coexistence. And although people would like for that to be the case, liberalism does not accept coexistence. Nationalism does. Nationalism in the true sense, where one's ethnic belonging is a primary determinant of the options available to him politically and socially. The nation as a second family, which, of course, and all the empirical studies on this, wherever you have a monoracial region or country, there is great social trust. Diversity destroys social trust. And I have numerous studies in academic journals where that is laid out in great detail. And of course, they're falling all over themselves saying, well, we're not nationalists, but they can't deny it, for the same reason that children can only be raised in a firm family structure, mother, father, and preferably an extended family. So too, politics and the economy can't function unless it is part of a ethnic and basically ethnically pure state. Now, of course, there's always going to be minorities. That's not important. But that leads to prosperity, trust, a lack of crime. And I have all the citations on this you can imagine. Nationalism is tried and true. Nationalism is the only thing that could focus on coexistence. The whole underlying premise of BRICS and the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, is coexistence. That liberal democracy can coexist with military government, a monarchy, an aristocracy, liberals essentially being oligarchs. That's true, because it's possible that a country like the U.S., which does not have to be involved anywhere but Central America, has a greater sense of security than, say, Belarus. Being involved in international politics has not benefited the U.S. in one way. It's hurt in every way. Even foreign trade is not really necessary for the U.S., since the U.S. has everything it needs locally. I saw bouquets of roses that are imported from Ecuador. You see this all the time. So the new international legal framework has to have some connection with nationalism, and hopefully connecting the ethnic reality, the design, the central core form of identity in a nation, usually typified by its faith. You know, the Arabs and Islam, Russian Orthodoxy, etc. And hopefully that can be connected with the state. Empires are out of the question, because it's the opposite of nationalism. An empire negates nationalism. But the only ideology that can talk about coexistence is the one that doesn't necessarily take its central core axioms from the Enlightenment. ethnicity has always existed and ethnic states have always existed. Some, you know, more self-conscious than others. And again, religion is a central defining feature of the ethnos, of the ethno-nation. That's the core of nationalism, not the state. The state exists exclusively as a protective coating over the nation. Now, of course, in the Western world, it's an oligarchy. The only thing they respect is money and power. And not only do they not represent the common, especially the common white man, the white worker in their countries, but in fact despises him and is bringing in millions of illegals to and illegal immigrants to displace him, despite the fact that you go to prison if you mention that to anybody and you don't live in the U.S. So long as liberalism is ascendant and finds its home in the United States, no new international legal framework for peaceful coexistence could ever be found. Liberalism is revolutionary, as is capitalism, no different than Marxism. It is revolutionary. It is globalist. It claims to be the fulfillment of history. Liberal capitalism is supposed to have ended history, a prejudice that's kind of still around. Therefore, it can't coexist, just like the Soviet Union, at least on paper, couldn't coexist. The whole purpose of the USSR was to export revolution and bring the whole world under its control. That was the point of it. Whatever independence they may have permitted in different parts of the world is a separate matter. But that's the whole reason the USSR exists and the Warsaw Pact. So again, capitalism and Marxism are the same. They do not brook any competition. You can't run for election in the West as a royalist, since it almost defeats itself. Royalism is one of the most anti-liberal things you can have, political systems you could even consider. But there's no way that you can seriously run on that, even in places like Belgium. Because it's unless you say how liberal we are. We're just as liberal as anybody else, we just want a crown. That's idiotic, of course. But the last thing that either socialism or capitalism want is that kind of diversity, peaceful coexistence. The U.S. subverts any country that doesn't serve its interests, starts civil wars, is responsible for the deaths of tens of millions in Central Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, etc. And this present war in Ukraine is exclusively because of the U.S. backing of the Ukrainian revolution in 2014. This is what the revolutionary movements do. A revolutionary movement, by its very structure, is universalist, internationalist, and wants to spread to every single corner of the planet, of the world. All right. That's all I have for today. I kept it to 30 minutes for once. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.